We need systems that are resilient. If the racism isn't going anywhere in our lifetimes, at least, we try our best, but we need systems that are resilient in the face of this type of retrenchment, because I do believe, Joe, that it's all connected. It's a pendulum shift, but it's more of a shift that you know is going to come back and forth over time, and we try to push it as far in the right direction as we can.
Hello, and thank you for listening in this week to Dwayne Morris, D&I 360 with Joe West. I am Eunika Anderson Howard, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Manager at Dwayne Morris. Today, we are honored to have joining us the President and Executive Director at Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, Damon Hewitt. Damon and Joe will have a candid conversation on the continued fight for civil rights and racial justice.
Hello, everybody. Joe West here, partner Dwayne Morris. I'm a member of our management committee, and I have the privilege of serving as the firm's chief diversity, equity, and inclusion officer. One of the other hats that I'm proud to wear is as co-chair for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. And with me today is the man in charge, the executive director of the Lawyers Committee, Damon Hewitt. Damon, how are you, sir?
I'm great, Joe. I'm so glad to be with you. Thanks for all that you're doing through your practice and through your service at the Lawyers Committee.
Well, let's jump right in. Talking of service, the service you've given not just to the Lawyers Committee, but to the cause of social justice over the course of your career is admirable. And it's one of the things that I respect and admire about you so much. Let's talk a little bit about that, Damon. Give the audience just a thumbnail sketch of your educational and career background and how you ended up landing, fortunately for all of us, with the Lawyers Committee.
Sure. Well, Joe, as you know, I grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana, proud native, for those who know the area, the 17th Ward, right there in the middle of the city. And grew up in the neighborhood that probably wasn't among the roughest, but also wasn't among the most fortunate, but where few of us in the neighborhood, especially young Black boys come Black men, actually were able to enjoy the benefits of, you know, the elite educational opportunities and job opportunities. In many ways, I was probably have been and continue to be viewed as an anomaly, something that haunts me and actually propels me to do much of the work I do. I stayed in state for college at Louisiana State University. I was a major in history, but all history was politics in Louisiana. So I've changed to poli sci. And of course, all poli sci majors become lawyers. Went on to the University of Pennsylvania Law School, where I read all the propaganda about how great the public interest program was, and Lina Guinier's picture was front and center. And I had the good fortune of being her research assistant my first year at Penn, a good thing because she went on to Harvard thereafter. And that put me on a fast track, quite honestly, and exposed me to a world of professionals and advocates who had committed their lives to racial justice and civil rights. There were many in New Orleans and Louisiana as well. However, not everyone was able to make a career of it. And I realized that it was possible to make a career of it. It did require me to turn down umpteenth, profits at major law firms. And I did summer at a law firm for half a summer, including DOJ. And also here at the Lawyers Committee, I interned as well about 25 years ago. So it's full circle for me. But knowing that I could dedicate my life to the fight for civil rights and racial justice and also make a living from it really opened up my eyes and opened up a pathway for me to do what I'm doing now.
Well, full disclosure for the audience's benefit, the very first firm that I worked at, one of the clients of the firm, major clients of the firm, was Hewitt Washington Architectural Firm. And your father, Lonnie Hewitt, was one of the very first clients who I represented in court. I actually had absolutely no idea what I was doing, but he was very kind, very generous, and very thoughtful. And he was someone I had immense respect for. So when I reconnected with you, I think you were with the Legal Defense Fund at right. The time. We spoke briefly on an amicus brief when I was at MCCA. Mm-hmm. And someone said, do you know Damon Hewitt? I said, if he's related to Lottie Hewitt, he's got to be a good guy. So your dad was actually one of my heroes, man. I just want you to know that.
Well, thanks so much, Joe. You know, I learned a lot from him, you know, as his firm was continues to be surviving his death, the longest operated, continuously operated Black owned architecture firm in the state of Louisiana, and among the oldest in the region, in the Southern region. I learned from him how he relates to folks in community. When he was working on projects and plans in public housing developments or things in which community really needed to have a voice and a say. Even after Hurricane Katrina, when all the rage was turning communities into green space and not having Black residents return, he was able to have a voice in that and put a lot of his capital, personal and professional capital, on the line. And I learned from him how to walk with and in service of community. And that's helped me be a better lawyer, no doubt.
Well, one of the other ways our paths reconnected was when Kristen Clark, your predecessor at the Lawyers Committee, brought you to my office. And, you know, again, she said, you know, David Hewitt, I said, absolutely. And as it turns out, you would end up having an enviable task of filling her large shoes when she was appointed the head of the one of the divisions in the Justice Department by President Biden. For people who don't know, Damon, tell them what the Lawyers Committee is, what it does, and why this is an important role for you.
Sure. Well, the Lawyers Committee is an organization that I like to describe as the steel that was forged in the fires of the Civil Rights Movement. We were convened at the behest of President John F. Kennedy in the summer of 1963. And Joe, as you know, that was the same summer that George Wallace stood in the schoolhouse door in Alabama to prevent integration of the school. It was the same summer where President Kennedy took to the airways to issue the first ever televised address by a sitting president talking about and calling for civil rights legislation and civil rights protections. And also the same summer that Medgar Evers was assassinated in his driveway in Jackson, Mississippi. And just weeks later, the Lawyers Committee was formed because the president knew at the time that even though his brother, Bobby Kennedy, was the Attorney General of the United States, that what the nation needed was a cohort, a cadre of private attorneys general to bring the best of the private bar, regardless of whether you're working for a nonprofit or working for a major law firm, bring your smarts, bring your capacity, bring your resources and your energies in this fight for civil rights. And that work continues today, almost 60 years later.
So speaking of that work continuing today, I know firsthand you've got a lot on your plate, my friend. Talk to people about some of the issues that are most pressing that take up your time and that keep you up at night in your role as the head of the Lawyers Committee.
Right. What is so much, you know, now that my kids are old enough to actually sleep, it's not them, it's keeping up at night, it is the work.
But David, I have news for you. Your kids will always
keep up. That's right. At some point, in different ways, right? But at any rate, look, you know, when I think about what's happening in this country, in a nutshell, I think about how the promise of democracy rings hollow for so many people. That is just words on paper. And that there's this kind of false moral equivalence between things that are abjectly bad and things that are supposed to be good, right? So all of a sudden, affirmative action and opportunity is alleged to be racism. All of a sudden, reproductive rights is alleged to be murder. When we don't see opportunity being open for people, people being able to have a living wage and affordable housing and high quality education, K-12 or higher ed, for that matter, we still see people being confronted, attacked, shot, killed by police unjustifiably. And quite often it's people of color, Black people in particular. And so the promise of democracy rings hollow for so many. And so as an organization, we do a lot, right? Sometimes more than I can even imagine that we could do, but there's so many fronts. And so we try to make big bets in a few areas. One of those, as you know, is the voting rights part of democracy. We have a choice in this country. We can make it easier to vote or harder to vote. And in too many states, we're going in the wrong direction when it comes to the ability to actually cast a ballot and then to make sure that ballot is counted, even to the point of the election not being contested successfully after the fact, even though there was a valid count. And we've seen so much of that, and we're bracing ourselves for more of that certainly for the midterm elections this year that are underway now, but also the 2024 presidential election, where we think things will really heat up. Another big issue for us is police accountability. We believe that Black people and all communities of color and all people in this country deserve not just freedom from being attacked and killed by police unjustifiably, but we also deserve protection and empathy, protection from racism and hate, whether it be white supremacists or whether it be within the ranks of the police department. And so people want to be safe, but they want to do it in a way that's on their terms, right? On their community's terms, so they can exercise some degree of self-determination. And there are so many legal and practical obstacles in the way of that. In terms of education, we have a very wide and broad footprint in higher education. The piece I'll talk about right now is on affirmative action. Our organization is the only civil rights organization involved in every one of the lawsuits in federal court in which the other side, as we call it, is challenging affirmative action programs, which are really, we call them diversity admissions programs, because it's not affirmative action as we once knew it, 15, 20, 30 years ago. But active certainly in the Harvard case and also in the UNC Chapel Hill case, where we represent defendant interveners, students whose voices were heard at trial because we lifted them up as witnesses, as our clients. And we are certainly fighting to make sure that voice is also heard as this matter goes up now to the US Supreme Court. Our lawyers should be able to be front and center arguing on behalf of those same students, a very diverse set of students, Black, Asian, and otherwise, and Latino students as well. And so we're also active, Joe, in the K-12 context. We know from watching even mainstream media that there are lots of attacks on so-called critical race theory. And I say so-called because most of what happens in our schools is not critical race theory.
That's right.
It's just a boogeyman concept. Now, I know critical race theory. I studied it as a student, had Derek Bell, the father of critical race theory, come and speak to my students when I taught the curriculum as well. But all it really is a mix of doctrinal law with a view towards understanding the role that race plays in development of the law. You can't read a civil procedure case Dred Scott technically is a civil procedure case. Who right. has standing and jurisdiction, and what court has jurisdiction to address these matters? Does this man's life matter? Does his humanity, is it recognized by the courts? That's essentially a standing issue, right? That's a doctrinal legal issue. But if you want to call it critical race theory, let's call it that. I'll tell you just a little bit of a sidebar, Joe. Our great friend, mutual friend, Kim Boyle, who also serves on our board, and she's in New Orleans, brought me down to New Orleans a couple of weeks ago to speak to a trial lawyers group. And the evening before I spoke, the governor of Louisiana, John Bel Edwards, spoke about how he granted a posthumous pardon to Homer Plessy of Plessy versus Ferguson fame. Many people think of it as a civil case, but Homer Plessy was criminally prosecuted for daring as a Black man to ride a train or a section of a train that was reserved for white people. And the morning that I spoke, just before I delivered the keynote, former New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu spoke about how he took down Confederate monuments in the city of New Orleans. And the point I made to that group, because governor and the mayor softened them up for me a bit, I said, hey, that's critical race theory. When you can utter the words white supremacy, when you can recognize the role that race and racism play historically and also to this day, in the legacy way, the legacy impact that it has, if you want to call it something, call it critical race theory. So don't be so scared of it as this fake boogeyman. So those are just some of the things we're working on, Joe. There's so much more in the realm of economic justice, in the realm of so many other things. I can go on and on, but I'm happy to talk more about them if you want to prompt me to.
Well, while you were talking, Damon, I thought about what I'll call a pendulum swing. Mm-hmm. In the wake of George Floyd's murder just about 2 years ago, there was this tremendous understanding and an appreciation for the ways in which race and the history of racism in this country has had a longstanding impact right. to this day on people of color generally and specifically African Americans. I mean, Mitt Romney was marching in Black Lives Matter Plaza, chanting Black Lives Matter. But it seems as if that sort of sugar rush of understanding and appreciation and a desire for fluency around issues of equity kind of burned off. And the pendulum has swung back in the other direction. In the minutes that we have left, talk a little bit about why you think that is and what can be done about it.
Well, I'm glad you called it sugar rush. It's a great term. And as any good cook knows, the sugar burns first when the temperature is high, right? It disappears or it leaves a char. And I think, look, in this case, as we've seen throughout history, progress is not linear. Right, we like to think of, in the context of Supreme Court parlance, in the capital context, evolving standards of decency, that more and more states recognize the folly and the tragedy of imposing a sentence of death upon people, especially for people who can't really defend themselves, who are infirm, who are young people at the time, what have you. That evolving standards of decency concept is consistent with the notion of progress just being linear and going one direction. But in reality, and we know this from history, even just the last 50 to 75 years of American history, that for every step or two forward, there's at least a half step, or if not a full step, backwards, that there's more of a zigzag. To put it in the language of the scholar Kim Crenshaw, there are cycles of reform and retrenchment that are fairly predictable when you think about it. You know, people these days who are, let's say, 35 to 40 years old, they live through Hurricane Katrina, if you were there or not, as you were, I know. They lived through the Gina Six. They lived through Michael Brown and George Floyd being killed. They've seen President Obama be elected. They saw Trump be elected. And when you look at all of these things, police brutality and economic ups and downs, you see that the progress goes back and forth, the zigzags. You see that the attacks on voting rights, critical race theory, even reproductive rights are part of a culture war that in the culture war typically flares up and is most vehement when you see things like rapid demographic shift, as we've seen in Georgia and Texas. You see voter suppression spike when there's a threat to entrenched power, especially power that tends to be adverse to the interests of communities of color. And so, you know, what we do learn from critical race theory is a concept called racial realism. It is not defeatist, right? But it is a notion that, let's be real, we know that there will be pushback. We know that there will be retrenchment. And so, as they say in the vernacular, we should act like we know. You know, we have to be prepared and braced for it. And we talk so much, and this is really a good DEI concept of resilience, individual resilience people talk about in the context of racism. We need systems that are resilient. If the racism isn't going anywhere in our lifetimes, at least, we try our best, but we need systems that are resilient in the face of this type of retrenchment, because I do believe, Joe, that it's all connected. It's a pendulum shift, but it's more of a shift that you know is gonna come back and forth over time, and we try to push it as far in the right direction as we can.
Damon, we just have a couple of minutes left. We'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the court. In the last maybe 3 or 4 weeks, we saw the first African-American woman confirmed to the Supreme Court. In the last 48 hours, we saw, as of this recording right now, we're just 2 days removed from the leak that put Justice Alito's draft on the Roe v. Wade out into the ecosystem and sort of like the blowback around that. Right. Talk a little bit about what's happening right now with the court, the extent to which the two things I just mentioned might have an impact on the court itself, and what you see going forward as far as the Supreme Court is concerned.
Well, I'm so glad you asked, Joe. You know, most Americans are socialized to think of the court, especially the U.S. Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, as a neutral arbiter of what's just and what is unjust, what's right, what's wrong. But I think it's time that we start thinking about the Supreme Court as a political project, that politics have always been in play to some degree. And it's really evident in the fact that President Obama served for 8 years as president of the United States and had only 2 appointments to the court. whereas Trump served for 4 years and had three appointments. And we know one of them was hijacked because Merrick Garland, who's now Attorney General, did not get even a hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee. So there's a lot of hypocrisy at play, but it's always been a political project. But what's very scary right now is the full-scale abandonment of principles that we call in our industry, stare decisis, respect for precedent. Precedent doesn't matter because what we're seeing, and Justice Alito, unfortunately, we saw this in his draft opinion that was leaked in the Dobbs case, the Mississippi abortion rights case, reproductive rights case, but also in his decision last summer in a case called Brnovich versus DNC, where he created out of whole cloth a brand new standard for certain types of claims under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which was already weakened years earlier in the Shelby County decision. It's almost kind of a choose your own adventure jurisprudence, Joe, where the precedent almost doesn't matter. What really the focus is on the ideological outcome and how to get there by drawing the shortest possible line, even if there are logical fallacies at play or whole-scale abandonment of first principles. And that's the real scary part. We have seen nuanced decisions that with which we've disagreed in the past, with which we thought were dead wrong, but now we're seeing almost zero respect for decades of precedent. It's a complete unearthing. And so, you know, we as lawyers have to be up to the task. I know that with justices like Ketanji Brown Jackson and hopefully more of her ilk in the future, that there can be a different day, but we're in a really tough time right now where we have to be not just super creative, but also have our head on a swivel because the threats I fear will grow. There's very little logical limiting principle or logical end to the kind of arguments we've seen in that draft opinion.
So sorry to interrupt you, Damon. Let me push back on you a little bit. All right. Challenge you here, as I know you know I can do, and I want you to be able to do as well. So I hear what you're saying, but right. You mentioned earlier in this conversation, Dred Scott. You mentioned earlier in this conversation, Plessy Ferguson.
Right.
You're proof positive that stare decisis is not always infallible, nor should it be.
That's right.
So what's your response to that?
Well, no, that's fair. And that, I think that question has come up a lot, which is why I believe the angle I think we're seeing in this draft opinion is a notion that not only Roe v. Wade, but also Planned Parenthood versus Casey in the 90s were wrong the day that they were decided. I think there is a fundamental difference, I would say, not just because I think that our side, so to speak, is right, is that there is very little context, in my view, in terms of historical context or present day context to what we're seeing in some of these cases. So in the voting rights case, the Brnovich case, it was almost as if there was a migration from a denial that racism and discrimination exists in voting to saying all of a sudden, well, it exists, but it's really hard to find here, that this is part of what we call the usual burdens of voting, to borrow a phrase from another Supreme Court case. That phrase was adopted by Justice Alito. And so he's essentially is saying that people are being denied opportunities to vote, but it's okay because it's a usual burden and that shouldn't constitute discrimination. Here in this case, in Dobbs, in Mississippi case, we're seeing likely something fairly similar, that the rights you think you have, you don't really have. The rights that you've relied upon for so long don't matter. The impact, disproportionate impact, as we've laid out in our amicus briefing in this case and other cases on this issue, that demonstrate the disproportionate impact on Black women and other women of color and poor women, that context doesn't matter at all in a rights jurisprudence. And so I think that, in my view, some of these decisions that are acontextual don't have the moral standing to actually unearth precedent the way that a Brown v. Board did essentially for Plessy v. Ferguson.
That's a good point. So real quick, last question I'm gonna ask you, Damon. The Lawyers Committee, you would say to me, and I agree with you, by the way, that it's at its core, it's politically agnostic. It really is focused on civil liberties for everyone, for evening the playing field. Why should people across the political spectrum and across the demographic perspective, Latinos, whites, males, female, various genders, Asians, Republicans, independents, Democrats, why should people in each of those groups care about the work of the Lawyers Committee?
Well, that's a great question, Joe. So our view about democracy writ large, right? Not just in a voting rights context, but overall, all the things that democracy promises, what we've learned the hard way in this country is that if democracy doesn't work for some of us, it really doesn't work for any of us at all. I think if you look at education and the need for a well-qualified and well-trained workforce that even corporate titans need, when you think about health, COVID spreads from one person to another indiscriminately, regardless of how much money you actually have, although we know that people at the lower end of that economic totem pole are more at risk, but it puts everyone at risk. We are more interdependent and interconnected society than people would like to believe. And so if the least of us, so to speak, are suffering, then this entire nation is going to suffer. This entire project we call democracy will never reach the heights that it could if we're holding some people back, whether it is through economic repression, voter suppression, or a knee on one's neck in the streets.
Damon, thank you, my friend, my homeboy.
Thank you, man. Appreciate you.
Appreciate all the work you're doing. And thank you for everything you're contributing to society, because you're doing God's work, brother.
Hey, you're doing it with us, and I appreciate you. And thanks for lifting up these issues through your platform.
Thank you.